It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Between research and practice, medical professionals are celebrating the virtues of personalized treatment. Now that idea is translating into a different system for healthcare. It's called direct primary care. Supporters say it's a personal approach that's affordable. Skeptics worry it serves only people of privilege. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of Wisconontext.org. He recently wrote a piece introducing the idea of direct primary care, and he's sitting in studio with me right now. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So are Wisconsin physicians and individuals using direct primary care now? What is this?
They are. We don't know exactly how many. You know, it's still a relatively small but vocal movement that's in the healthcare system. And basically, the idea of direct primary care is that you have a direct relationship with a primary care practice where you're essentially purchasing a recurring membership type package of services. Rather than going to the doctor and having the doctor bill your insurance company for each visit.
And how much does it cost per patient?
It can vary, but, you know, some places get down as low as, you know, $100 a month or $80 a month.
And so my question is, does this replace insurance or is it in addition to insurance?
Well, the thing is that it's not actually health insurance. And in fact, most of the states that have passed laws around direct primary care even specify that it's not insurance. And the direct primary care folks who advocate for this actually like that because they don't want to be regulated as insurance. Mm. And so it creates this question of, kind of how do you integrate this with the wider healthcare system and with all the other needs that patients have beyond what a primary care practice can do.
I feel like if I'm a healthy individual, especially if I'm a young healthy individual, then I'm going to buy insurance because I still have to buy insurance. What would make me say I'm going to pay this extra $100 a month or so to my primary care doctor when I could just go to my primary care doctor and have a relationship with them with my insurance?
Right. In some cases, the idea is that you have this direct primary care membership, and then you have a bigger insurance policy that's, it's often called a wraparound policy that sort of provides for bigger, more catastrophic things. You know, what direct primary care advocates are saying basically is that it doesn't really make sense for primary care doctors to be billing insurance for things, and that insurance should be for the bigger, more catastrophic stuff. And, you know, I've had people argue to me that using your health insurance for primary care is a lot like it would be like using your car insurance to get a brake replacement or an oil change
interesting.
You know, maintenance, things like that.
Okay, so if I am going to decide to get primary care, what is it that this doctor and this kind of arrangement is going to give me health-wise that just, you know, going to a regular clinic isn't going to get me?
Well, ideally, for one thing, your membership to these practices gets you sort of an unlimited degree of access to a point, you know, rather than being charged every time you have an appointment or get a given service or test or what have you. So it's sort of a more, again, the membership model is a bit more open. And ideally, it's supposed to give people a more, I keep using the word direct, which is the name of it, but a more personal one-on-one relationship with their doctor. Is supposed to free up the doctor's time and resources to spend more one-on-one time with their patients because they're not devoting their time or their staff or energy to things like filling out insurance paperwork and so forth, because in this case, kind of the insurance thing has been taken out of the picture a bit.
So my question is, if a doctor theoretically, the doctor can spend more than 15 minutes at a time with me if I am paying my monthly fee, and he takes too many subscribers, sort of like overfilling an airplane. What can I do to say, hey, you were supposed to be spending more time with me and you're not?
That's a really good question. And at least in Wisconsin, I haven't seen anybody, you know, put forth legislation or regulation ideas that would sort of solve that problem. You know, I guess if it got really bad to a certain point, a patient could try to sue them for breach of contract or something like that. But it's, yeah, it's something that currently in the state is not regulated. In some states, there are some rules surrounding it that differ a bit from one place to another. But yeah, right now, I don't see there being a really solid solution to that problem.
Interesting. And doctors don't want it regulated, right?
Well, it seems like they don't, or at least they don't want it regulated as insurance, because they don't want, because again, I think the whole point for them is kind of getting away a bit from having to deal with that system quite so much. So
this is not concierge medicine. Concierge medicine is something different.
Right. That's something where the very rich sort of pay for, a slate of medical services and go around conventional medical insurance. And sort of one of the ideas of direct primary care is to take that idea and turn it into something that is more affordable for people who aren't super wealthy.
And if I have things like maybe allergy management, maybe a bit of arthritis, something simple to take care of, this works for me. At what point do doctors say this, your chronic disease is too much for this particular idea?
Well, I mean, one thing that hasn't really been codified and standardized, and certainly hasn't been in Wisconsin, is how direct primary care connects into all these other services. How if the doctor isn't part of this bigger medical hospital or practice or what have you, then they have to come up with a way of referring people out to specialists, and people have to figure out how to get that care covered. And so it's something that direct primary care doctors are certainly thinking about and have, some solutions to. There's some online things that they've gotten into to try to connect them with specialists and things like that. And obviously people will kind of draw on their professional connections from just working in the field. But again, it's not a completely standardized thing, what your direct primary care practice does or doesn't offer, and then how they go about sort of coordinating with all the other kinds of care you might be getting.
So I have been to the doctor before where I've had to go to the doctor. I know that I have a sinus infection, or I know that I need a particular prescription, but I got to go to the doctor. The doctor comes in and looks at me for like 2 seconds and says, okay, because they can see it in my eyes, they can see it in my face. Is this going to be able to mitigate that? Like, could the doctor video chat with me without some insurance company saying, oh, no, you must be there in person with that person?
Yeah, one thing that they've talked about is that this opens up the door a little bit to being able to just, have a phone call or a Skype call or what have you, I guess, and expedite that process when they know it's not something that necessarily warrants having a whole office visit.
On the other hand, what do malpractice insurers think about this kind of thing?
That's something I haven't really looked into, and I'd like to find out more about it. And again, the whole thing that's interesting about this to me as a reporter is that so little about it has been really standardized, mm-hmm. or codified. And again, the states that do regulate it and have passed laws around it have taken differing approaches. Some Wisconsin legislators currently have convened a study group that's sort of looking at it. There was a bill earlier this year that would have addressed direct primary care, but it died in the state Senate. So, a lot of folks are still trying to figure out, again, how does this fit into this bigger medical system and everybody's needs? How does it fit into things like Medicare and Medicaid?
Mm-hmm.
Those all seem to be very much open questions right now.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext.org. He recently wrote a piece talking about a new method of healthcare called direct primary care. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. That. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Part of our celebration of summer camp includes a tale of summer sleepaway camp. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a wild and kind of lively story.
summer sleepaway camp. For some kids, it's the highlight of their year, where the innocence of childhood meets a magical, sometimes mischievous, world of semi-independence. Writer Eric Dregney reminisces on a particular day at a summer camp in Wisconsin through his essay, How We Tamed Nature.
At 9 years old, I was pretty sure I could tame nature. I had a bow with a quiver full of arrows and a belt to carry a small pickaxe and a leather case for a deadly sharp fishing knife, none of which my parents let me carry to camp. My mom signed me up for 2 weeks of overnight camp deep in the north woods of Wisconsin. Our two counselors, Nick and Dan, would rather chase girls than be shackled with needy boys who refused to bathe. We figured our smell would keep away the wild animals and the girls. They took us zigzagging across the lake in canoes into the deep, dark woods for a 3-day overnight. At the campsite, the counselors wanted to relax in the sun and go skinny dipping. They correctly figured that we timid preteens wanted nothing to do with nudity. We hauled the bags to the campsite while the counselors sunbathed naked in the warm sun down by the lake. What they didn't count on was that 10-year-old Robbie would find the hatchet in the food sack. He bragged how his dad took him hunting so he knew how to survive out in the wilderness, just like Grizzly Adams. We ducked as he swung the small axe like a berserker Viking to cut down trees. When that proved tiresome, he chopped at stones to watch sparks fly. The chipped hatchet was soon dull as a hammer, but he said his weapon made him king of our tribe, kind of like Lord of the Flies. Then Johnny, the kid with a Let's Boogie t-shirt, discovered a box of matches. He wanted to make s'mores, but Alex, the husky kid in desperate need of a belt, had already finished off all the Hershey's chocolate bars. Alex's hand was deep in the marshmallows when I snatched the sack from his grasp. We could at least roast them over the campfire. Despite Johnny using nearly the whole box of matches to light the logs, he couldn't keep the flames alive. We had no paper, so for some reason he burned the tent rope, which smoldered into a useless mass. He smiled from the dizzying effects of the fumes. Meanwhile, Robbie covered every inch of his body with bug spray, and Johnny discovered that deep woods off is highly flammable. He held up a match, and a huge flame emitted from the aerosol can towards the logs. He laughed at the singed hair on his hands. We impaled marshmallows on sharpened green sticks to roast with Johnny's makeshift flamethrower. Johnny used up all his bug spray, but the logs finally sizzled to life. We applauded his inventive camping skills. As we feasted on marshmallows cooked with flaming insecticide, the counselors ventured back from the beach, drawn by the bizarre smell of burning chemicals and caramelized sugar. Nick and Dan finally put clothes on and admired the blaze Johnny had started. They grabbed the hatchet from Robbie, who had chopped off every low-hanging branch he could reach. Just as they noticed the molten mass of rope that we'd needed to set up the tents properly, Johnny tossed his used-up can of off on the fire. "Get down!" Nick yelled. "This could blow!" We ducked quickly behind the trees. Nick grabbed a griddle to use as a shield and slowly approached the fire. Despite our fear, we were all awed by the impressive boom of the exploding aerosol can and the ensuing mini-mushroom cloud. We had finally frightened ourselves into submission. I can't say, though, that it stopped us from wanting more.
Eric Dregney is the author of several books and teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Maureen McCollum is, of course, the producer of Wisconsin Life. We are talking about summer camp stories, summer camp experiences. You have about 12 minutes to call in, but we would love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is where you can email us, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tell us about your experience with summer camp. Did you like it? Did you hate it? Did you hate it at first and maybe learn to like it? Was there something something that happened to you? We have to keep it clean here on the morning show, but was there something that happened that maybe changed your life at a summer camp? 800-642-1234. We are sitting here with executive producer of the morning show, Keely Boltina, and I asked you yesterday if you ever went to summer camp, and your thought immediately went to in the woods, you know, traditional summer camp, and
yeah,
you said
pass.
No, right, right. Uh-huh. But then you went and thought about it, and we're like, oh, yeah, right, I did go to summer camp. Talk to me about that.
I went to debate camp, which is far
which
more...
Which does not surprise me at all.
It is far more exciting than it seems, let me
totally
tell you.
Agree.
And I realized last night that it really did what other summer camps do, right? Took me out of my small town, South Dakota, put me in a room with a bunch of other people with different views, and helped me understand like who I was apart from the life that I knew every single day. And that's kind of the part of summer camp, to just be away.
Just be away. So we asked some people around here about their summer camp experiences, and we're going to start with digital news editor Jenny Peek. She was a camper, and she then was a counselor at a summer camp, and she shared this story about her time as a counselor.
So at my camp, when little kids were homesick, our secret lingo for that was we called them marshmallows so that nobody would know that there was a big issue going on. So everyone had a radio at our camp because it was pretty spread out. And if you needed help dealing with a marshmallow, someone would come on the radio and say, hey, I need a counselor in Oneida or Algonquin, because all of our campsites were named after different Native American tribes in Wisconsin. And they would hop on and say, we need Jenny over in Algonquin. We've got a marshmallow, and we know she's really good at dealing with them. So I would go over and make the kids realize that they were in for the time of their life and that they had nothing to be afraid of.
So, Carrie, were you a marshmallow?
I was totally a marshmallow. I went to my camp experience, much like Jenny's. And by the way, I'm not surprised that Jenny is good at dealing with people who are panicking. She's pretty awesome. But I had a camp experience, and then later I had a counselor experience. And my camp experience, I was 11. I was out of my element. It was a horse camp and a shooting camp, actually. I learned how to shoot guns. I was only 11, so I could only shoot 22s. But I was totally, totally, totally homesick the entire 2 weeks I was there. It was very sad, and I have mixed memories of it.
And those counselors helped get you through. Hey,
for the
listen,
most part, yeah.
Not every camp memory is going to be a positive one. Sometimes things linger.
Yes.
We have a story from producer Chris Molina about a swimming test that didn't go exactly the way he planned.
The thing that I remember most from summer camp was being at a Boy Scout summer camp years and years and years ago, and one of the first things that you had to do at summer camp was you had to take a swimming test. So you had to jump into the lake, and you had to swim down and back, down and back, down and back, down and back, something like that. I think you had to go the length of the little swimming area like 4 times. So I was always nervous about the swimming test because I wasn't a fantastic swimmer, but I was always good enough to get by, and this year, I jumped in the water for the swimming test, and I started swimming, and apparently there was a lot of aluminum or something in the water because my nose started bleeding, and I had gotten about 1 lap done, and then the lifeguard started blowing his whistle and telling me to get out of the water because I had blood all over my face. So I got out of the water, I cleaned myself up, I took Kleenex, I doused my face down, and I was fine, and I came back out thinking, all right, I'll just pick up my swimming test where I left off. And the lifeguard says, no, you have to start it over. And I said, well, what do you mean? I'm tired. I already did part of the swimming test. And he said, no, you have to do it over. So as a result, I could not finish my swimming test. I tried. I could not finish it. And I did not get swimmer status that summer. I got beginner swimmer status, which means that I could not rent any boats, a fact which I am still apparently upset about 20 years later.
A learning experience, oh, for sure.
Poor Chris. We've got a final one here from Stephanie Elkins. Listeners might know Stephanie as a host of The Morning Show on our classical network.
The summer that I was 13, I went to a special Girl Scout camp, and we went canoeing and camping down the Potomac River, and it turned out to be a really cold and rainy week, and all of us, every single one of us to a girl, dreamed about grilled cheese sandwiches and tomato soup, and we talked about it the entire time, the texture of the grilled cheese, how you'd make the tomato soup. It was just wonderful. But that trip really ignited a love of being on the water in me that still persists to this day.
So she had a love of the water, even though she got rained on the entire time. That's pretty awesome.
I don't know. That's being a pretty good sport, and I'm not sure that I have that in me. But, you know, that's the point of summer camp. Again, you get away. You're not in school. It's something different. You can connect with whatever is outside of the norm for you, and that's the point, right? You learn. You grow.
You learn and you grow. And by the way, that marshmallow thing, I came away from that with some pretty good experiences.
Absolutely.
And with some pretty good memories. I just, in the moment, couldn't sort of like deal with it. So that was nice. And yeah, if you have summer camp experiences, share them with us on Twitter. That would be a really nice thing. You could share them with me at Carrie Kaufman. And we will put them on our Twitter feed. Keely Bultina, thank you for joining me today to talk about summer camp and play some of these clips.
You are welcome.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Dane County Executive Joe Parisi has had a long week after the flooding Monday night into Tuesday morning that left people stranded, roads looking like rivers and parks looking like lakes. Parisi took a tour of the county to survey the damage and document it for us on Twitter. In addition to keeping us posted both before and after the flooding, Parisi also told followers that he would be declaring a state of emergency for the county. And unfortunately, there may be more flooding to come. Joe Parisi joins us now. Welcome to the show, sir.
Good morning.
We are taking calls on this segment. I would like to know if you had flooding, if you maybe were stuck somewhere like in the Costco on Tuesday, if you're expecting flooding and what you're doing about it now. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So there is additional rain in the forecast today, Joe. What's Dane County doing to prepare for this?
Yeah, we're in a couple of different modes depending on what part of the county we're looking at. As everyone is aware of, the western side of the county received the initial brunt of the storm and the initial flooding with swelling rivers and flash flooding. Most of that part of the county is now in a cleanup, recovery, and assessment mode. When you move further east, when you get into the Madison's Isthmus, kind of the near east side, and then eastern Dane County, now that portion of the county is dealing with the aftermath of that water moving through the system. So as you get further east now, we have the lakes filling up. We still have a lot of that water to come through. Even if it doesn't rain, it takes over a week for the water to move through the system. So currently, all of our lakes are at or above their 100-year high levels. We have the dam at the Tenney Locks, which is Lake Mendota, the first in the chain, wide open, and we are seeing rising waters on the Yahara River and on Lakes Monona, Wabisa, and Kaganza. So residents downstream of that are sandbagging and preparing for increases. We saw about 3 inches in an increase in the levels yesterday, and that's rising. So we have a lot going on. And in the situation in the Isthmus of Madison is a little different because that's not a situation of water coming over the banks. That's a situation in which the stormwater drains empty right into the Yahara River and into the chain of lakes, and the levels now are over those drains. So what we see in a number of streets in the Isthmus is when it rains and those levels go up, the water comes back up through those storm sewer drains. Those are not sanitary sewers, they're storm sewers. So we have a number of different situations depending on what part of the county you're in.
Okay, so let me talk to you about the river. People live on that river, right?
Oh, yes, and along all of our lakes, yep.
And what are they doing? What are you recommending that they do right now?
Again, it depends where folks live. There's a lot of sandbagging going on right now. So if your issue is caused by water going over the banks, that's where the sandbagging is occurring. It's a little more complicated inland in the isthmus because that's where the water pools up through the storm sewers. So, you know, only certain types of sandbagging may work depending on what block you're in, but that's not water coming over the top. One thing I mention, we have a website set up to keep people posted on the latest news, the latest closings, resources, et cetera. And if people just go to countyofdane.com, countyofdane.com is the main county website, and there's a very obvious link to click on there for resources and updates on street closings, et cetera.
We will have that on our website also, and I will we'll talk about this later. Are there any? I looked at a flood map earlier of the isthmus, and it looked like pretty much the entire east side was flooded in some way, shape, or form. Can people get across the isthmus?
Yeah, right now people can get across. East Johnson Street is closed. Certain lanes on East Washington are closed. That could change throughout the day depending on the water levels and on how much rain we get. We're forecast to get, I believe, about a quarter inch today, then fairly quiet till Sunday, which is better news than we had yesterday. We're certainly not out of the woods. But people need to just be aware, check that website, listen to the media outlets, because the street closures are changing, you know, as we speak. But people need to obviously allow for a lot more time. Please practice patience. And as always, please do not drive through water. Do not move barricades and try to pass. That situation never ends up well.
Do not drive through water. Do not drive through water. I can't repeat that enough. I guess there's two things that people can do. They can either, if they're coming to work on the, sort of the western side of the isthmus, they could bring a backpack if they get stuck here, or they can just end up driving around to get home. Are there any warnings for how crowded our highways are going to be?
Well, It will be very crowded in certain areas, particularly if East Washington closes down. You know, the good news there is that Williamson Street remains open if Washington closes. And Williamson Street is up pretty high, so we're not really concerned at this point that would close. But, you know, it's an ever-changing situation, and people just need to be aware. They can follow, you know, Dane County Emergency Management, Twitter. Local municipalities are getting the word out, too. We all coordinate with each other. So it's, you know, it's just be aware and be careful.
We are talking with Joe Parisi, who is the county executive of Dane County, and he's been dealing with all of the flooding that's been happening this week and that may happen now today and over the weekend. You've been visiting the areas out west that got hard hit. Talk to us about some of the damage you're seeing.
Yeah, one of the hardest hit communities that I've witnessed has been Mazamani. They got hit very hard. Hundreds of homes inundated. The streets in many areas of Mazamani are just lined with debris that people have had to take out of their homes. You know, we actually just got in our preliminary damage assessment from across the county. We're asking people to document, and United Way's 211 is helping folks with that information. And our preliminary estimate, damage estimate to the private sector, to private homes and private businesses, we've had 859 reports of damages into 291, totaling over $69 million in damages.
And is there any help for the people who got damaged? Because a lot of people don't have flood insurance.
Right. So what we're doing, the reason we document this, so it's over $69 million in damages in the private sector, over $38 million in the public sector, so a total of over $100 million in damages so far and counting. So we document this. That's part of the reason for declaring the state of emergency. That sets the wheels in motion for us to apply through the state to the federal government, to FEMA, for assistance, which could come in the form of low-interest loans, potentially grants for people who receive extensive damages. But it's a tough hurdle to get over, because there's not always a lot of assistance on the federal level available. So we want to do what we can to access what may be available, and so documentation is very important.
You've been talking to people who have been hit. What are they saying? What's their state of mind right now?
Well, you know, I think it's the reality is beginning to sink in to folks. I mean, something like this happens very quickly, and the forecast certainly did not call for 15 inches of rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of shocking to folks at first. But, you know, again, in Mazamani, for example, neighbors are helping neighbors, communities are helping other communities, and people are just moving forward and doing what they need to do. But it's, you know, it's pretty devastating. The impact of a flood lasts for a long time, particularly in houses that had flooding up to the first floor, where major extensive renovations are going to have to occur. And again, it's, you know, we're dealing with the assessment piece, but then it's also a very active and unfolding situation in a number of other parts of the county. So other folks are in the preparedness and gathering information mode.
So we talked a few minutes ago about sandbags won't really do any good if you're on the isthmus because the water is coming up from the ground.
Not that they won't do any good. It's situational. There's
okay.
Some situations where it will, but others, you know, it's again because it, like you said, it's coming up from the sewer system, from the storm sewers, and not over the lake.
And this is not dirty water that's coming up. Let's be clear about that. It's not sewer water. It's clean water. It's just coming up through the system.
Yes. Right. It's lake water. It's the water that usually drains through the storm sewers is coming up. You know, it's not the sewage districts.
Okay. So, but if I need sandbags, where do I get them?
Depending on where you live, you go to your local municipality, and on our webpage, our flooding webpage, we have a list of the outlets where people can get sandbags. And so we're working, we're supplying sandbags to municipalities if they need them. We have a sandbagging machine in one municipality, and we're bringing one in to another. Unfortunately, there won't be enough to go around for everyone. Most of it will be manual filling of that. But there will be enough sandbags. Contact your local municipality if you need to. But again, that website has a lot of information for people.
And you talked about the Tenney Dam at Tenney Park. Are you releasing any water there?
We're releasing a lot of water there. The dam is full open, and one of the outlets, one of the lanes where the boats come through, is open at this time right now too, because we need to make some more room in that body of water for the rains that are coming. We need to be moving as much water through the system as possible. So that's, you know, and even if there were no rain, that would still be, you know, days that it would take for that to move through.
And really quickly, are there boating and swimming warnings here?
Well, we're not. There's a slow no wake order on every lake right now, and there are no boats going through the Tenney Dam. The Tenney Locks, pardon me.
And what about the lakes? The lakes are slow, no wake. What about swimming?
Swimming, I would urge people to be very, very cautious. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, swiftly running water, and especially the water that's up, that's up where it usually is not standing. The beaches are closed. So this is a time for people to just exercise extreme caution for the next week, and it's better safe than sorry.
I think summer is over. I think it's time to go back to school and turn away from the lakes. We've been talking to Joe Parisi. He is the county executive for Dane County. He's been dealing with flooding this week and possibly, hopefully not, flooding to come over the weekend. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
I want to give out that website again. It's countyofdane.com. You can get a list of an update of flooding and a list of where you can get sandbags. We're going to have that posted with our segment notes on WPR.org. We're also going to tweet it out. That is countyofdane.com. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. The legislature came out with a proposed UW budget, and it reflects two different views of higher education. Republican leaders say the budget is fiscally responsible and focuses on job training. Democrats say it is a dismantling of the Wisconsin idea of inculcating people with critical thinking skills. Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter has been covering this, and she's with us this morning. Laurel, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
I should note that your full name is Laurel White, and you are our state capitol reporter. So briefly, what does the budget for the UW system call for?
So this budget proposal, which was released this week by the UW system, calls for about $108 million in a spending increase over the next 2 years. So that's a pretty hefty increase compared to their last request. The last request was only a $42.5 million increase, for a little context. parts of it's kind of broken into two big pieces. $82.5 million of that funding bump is for these new performance-based measures that people may have heard about, and then $25 million is for these capacity-building programs that are aimed at specific things like, expanding science and health programs, things for high-demand careers in Wisconsin.
So talk to me about what the performance measures are.
Yeah, so these are really interesting. The legislature approved these in consultation with the UW system earlier this year, and they're pretty controversial. So they're performance measures that schools have to hit, benchmarks that they have to meet in order to get the funding. So that $82.5 million that I mentioned before, that will be paid out if schools don't meet these benchmarks. Now, schools helped come up with the benchmarks. They're for things like graduation rates, retention rates, things like that, things that they say they want to do well, and the legislature says we need more accountability and transparency for things like that.
Do you I feel like higher education or education in general has been fighting against that, this sort of like business accountability thing. Do they go together? Are there people who say that, no, you have to go get an education to learn things, not to necessarily take tests?
That's pretty much exactly what part of the Democratic argument was this week, Carrie. So Democrats came out. I spoke to one in particular who really focused on this issue, Katrina Shanklin, who's from Stevens Point, and she's a member of the State Budget Committee. So, of course, they review all of these budget proposals, edit them, pass them, send them to the full legislature. So they're very important in this budget process. And she said that she feels like this UW system proposal is catering too much to Republican policy goals that have been in the legislature for the past several years, things like focusing on business development, workforce development, these kind of business-like outcomes in these performance-based measures. And she says that she feels like the budget is not necessarily reflective of what schools actually need and what she's been told schools need. She thinks that it's maybe angling a little bit too much at those political goals.
And what has she been told that schools need?
Well, she referenced specifically, folks may remember this, those 13 majors that are proposed to be cut at UW Stevens Point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's obviously a big issue for her. That's in her area. And she says that if we have money to be investing in the UW system, we need to be supporting these programs that are being cut rather than tying money to specific things like expanding health and science programs, for example.
So what I'm hearing, maybe what I'm hearing is that there's a disconnect between we need to teach people critical thinking skills and we need to teach people specific job skills. Is there any way that those two things can come together?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I feel like so I spoke with the two co-chairs of the budget committee this week, too. That's Senator Alberta Darling and Representative John Nygren. And, you know, they said, Darling in particular said that she thinks most people in Wisconsin would agree that we need to focus on growing Wisconsin's workforce in these high demand areas, science, technology, healthcare, and that it makes sense to harness the power of UW's system to help grow the state economy, that's just logical. And what Nygren said is that he believes that the investments in the school in general, that it's doing well. He pointed out, you know, this is still a desirable place for students to go, whether they're from Wisconsin or they're from out of state. The UW system is still very well respected. Obviously, it's still doing well. So they're arguing that they can have a well-rounded university system with a specific focus on these things that the Wisconsin economy needs.
And the healthcare expansion capacity, is there a strategy here? Is this really, let's get people out into the workforce? Or is there some other sort of larger strategy?
I mean, I think that's the specific goal here. And it's very interesting, actually, to look at each school has specific proposals for doing things to feed these high-demand majors, career paths, whatever you want to call them. So I have a huge document with all these examples, but just so people can kind of, it's not abstract. For example, at the UW-Madison, they want to increase faculty in computer science programs. The UW-Milwaukee wants to add new programming in areas like artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And the UW-Barron County wants to create a Bachelor of Science in Nursing program. So those are things that don't exist right now that, you know, that there's a push saying we need more people doing these things in Wisconsin. So here's funding to do that, to create these programs so people can graduate with these degrees and hopefully then stay in Wisconsin after they graduate and work here.
Okay, so is there incentive to create these programs at the university, or the universities, I should say. Part of this $82 million, is that going to also include incentives for students to go into these majors, perhaps scholarships?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is so. Not necessarily part of this budget proposal, but some people might remember that the governor just proposed a set of new tax breaks and incentives at the beginning of his general election campaign. And one of those is a $5,000 over 5-year tax credit for college graduates who live and work in Wisconsin in these high-demand fields. So it's clear that this is part of kind of the policy coming out of the Capitol to support and incentivize young people to study these subjects, to get jobs in these fields, and to stay in Wisconsin when they do.
So the governor obviously is in a reelection campaign. Does his opponent, Tony Evers, say anything about this?
Well, Evers obviously is a big education guy. He's the state school superintendent. Mm-hmm. So I think his biggest pushback on this budget proposal is that they haven't done something that's called fund the freeze. So the UW system has had a tuition freeze for the past several years. And what a number of Democrats are pushing for is to increase state funding to compensate for tuition not going up over the past several years. They say that you're sort of squeezing the university because costs go up. And if tuition isn't going up, then that's detrimental to university programs. And that's a big thing that Evers has pointed to and said, if we're going to continue the tuition freeze, which is part of the plan in this budget proposal, we need to put more money into the system.
And this is the $250 million that has been cut from the budget, this tuition freeze?
That's a separate.
Wow.
That's a whole separate thing. So that $250 million was cut in the 2015-2017 state budget. But there's also been, prior to that, a tuition freeze that was instated. So students wouldn't be paying more out of their pockets. You know, the governor and others have pushed for that thing. It makes school more affordable. But a lot of people have been saying, well, the university's being squeezed because of that.
We've been talking about the UW budget with Laurel White, who is WPR's state capitol reporter. This story is going to have many iterations, and we're going to wrangle Laura to join us for the twists and turns in the future. Laurel, I started off the week with you. I'm ending the week with you. Thank you for being on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.